Hello, and welcome to Cubicle Confidential, weekly advice for the working stiff. I'm Chris DeSantis, author, podcaster, speaker, and avid fan of reading.
And I'm Tim McClure. I help companies with strategy, structure, and market research. And I think I have a problem with tea.
Tea is in the letter or the beverage?
No, tea is in the brewed beverage, and we can get into that. But tell me, reading, you said. What are you reading right now? I'm very curious. What's on your bedside table?
Right now, I'm reading The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. I like his work. I've read The Happiness Hypothesis and The Coddling of the American Mind. And he's a very interesting author, sort of philosophical and a social psychologist, just a really fascinating read. On the side, though, I also read something that is brainless. I hate to say brainless, but let's say distracting. And so I'm in a Dean Koontz novel.
Wow. So you got a highbrow, lowbrow, and you're thumbing through both of these at the same time. Is that a good balance, or is that hard to do?
Well, you know, what I do is I'll read one book for a while, and then a different part of the day, I will read another book. So, and that's, are you reading anything of note? Because I'm a big fan of, listeners, if there's something that you're reading that is interesting, send it in. Because I'm always interested in reading something interesting.
Yeah, I have, that's an interesting question. So my family would tell you, I only read on vacation. And when I read, I like to read like I'm watching movies. So I like to start it and finish it and please leave me alone while I'm doing that. Oh. It's not like a night after night kind of thing. During the week, my wife, our recurring character here, will nudge me. Why don't you read this? Why don't you read that? And what I always say is I consume information for a living. So when I want to relax, I would like lights and sounds to wash over me and not have to think about it too much. So, you know, that's interesting. You know, the reading is a segue to tea. So let me explain this to you.
Oh, yeah, the tea.
I'm trying to get into tea, and my history with tea is, you know, it's Lipton, it's Bigelow, it's, you know, tea in a box, that kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. in the cabinet, the family is really into this tea, and it's kind of like this roll-your-own-cigarette situation. There are all these loose teas, and they're fancy and exotic, and they have all these tasting notes, and you kind of make your own bag, and then you steep it, and it's amazing. I mean, for 2 weeks, I've been so excited to do this, and they smell incredible, and they taste like nothing. So my issue is, it's like they're over-promising with the nose of the tea, and then when I drink it, it's sort of like, it's not, you know, it smells good. It doesn't really taste good. I don't know if there's something wrong with me or the way I'm brewing it, but just disappointment after disappointment with the teas.
Are you more partial to tea or coffee?
Well, I like coffee, and I drink coffee every day. Coffee. The day can't start without coffee, but I can't drink that too late in the afternoon.
Right.
As I get older, but you know, tea, it's a warm beverage. It's a little bit of a ritual to make it. I like to kind of sip it. You know, I ponder and solve the problems of the world. That's kind of why I like mm-hmm. to do that. And I thought tea would be an interesting way to do that without, you know, too much caffeine. And really, I guess hot water and honey tastes better to me than a lot of these fancy teas that I'm spending 8 minutes putting this thing together.
Well, I'm just glad you're experimenting. I think it's very nice, and I've never been a fan of tea, quite frankly. I like the idea of it. I just don't, to your point, I don't think there's enough punch in it. You know, there's not enough taste to it for my, you know, it just doesn't resonate as well.
It's a little like Jack. Any strong opinions about tea one way or the other? Fan?
What you were saying, there is a practice, a tea meditation that is part of the Buddhist practice. It's, you mindfully boil the water, you get the tea out, you watch it steep, it's a way of being
right.
in
the Japanese have a variation.
Right, yes. Exactly.
They have a tea ceremony.
Right, so right. I think in that case, it's pretty cool. I'll drink whatever's in front of me. I'm not too picky about, I mean, obviously.
Confession. Cubicle confessions.
I didn't start drinking coffee until I was in my 20s because my mom told me it would stunt my growth, which is not true. You know, I was in college when I started drinking coffee, and then I was like, oh my God, what have I been doing? I wasting time not drinking coffee. I would fall asleep. I was in this art history class. I'd fall asleep every day. It was just warm, and the teacher spoke very soothingly, and I felt bad that I was falling asleep, so then I would sit in the front row because I was like, well, I'm not going to fall asleep if I'm in the front row, and then I would just fall right asleep in the front row.
Oh, dear.
And then I had like a Dunkin' Donuts at like 22, and I was like mad in so many different ways.
Yeah, you'd been asleep for half your life and you didn't know it.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, you know, so that Japanese tea ceremony, maybe that's a good intro to our topic of the day, Chris.
Oh, what a great segue. Right. Foreign to me is our topic of the day. So that's very interesting. In fact, we have two questions. Again, this week's episode, we'll do two questions, and we'll be reaching out to an imaginary sponsor once more, hopeful as we are.
Yes, willing it into existence.
Exactly. And then we'll wrap this up with the gist, which is a reference to an article that we have found on the internet that in some way relates to the topic at hand. So you ready for the first question?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hello. I am working with an Asian American female who's probably one of the smartest people I have ever worked with. She comes up with great ideas, does an excellent job of not only conceptualizing what needs to be done, but she can create a plan to make it happen that's always spot on. I know this about her, and our boss knows this, but he's not sharing this with anyone. In fact, he is so vague that people think it's his work, and he never says it isn't.
No.
Well, being gay, I don't appreciate people I don't know well bringing up my sexuality since it's not relevant to my work. Now, so I am reluctant to talk to her about what she might consider stereotyping of an Asian American female in the workplace as being polite, quiet, and non-assertive. I want to help her, but I don't want to offend her. Can I? Signed, Defending or Offending in St. Paul.
Wow. There's so much that's in here. It makes me want to pause and have an 8-minute tea meditation and think this one over. So first thing is, you know, how great that you've got this strong performer on your team and that you're recognizing this person and maybe inclined to advocate on her behalf. So I think that's good. That's noble and good for you, defending or offending in St. Paul. Mm-hmm. I think the way I might come at this is just forget the stereotype. Don't lean into that. You have an opportunity here to advocate for a coworker who isn't getting credit. It's that simple. We don't have to have the other baggage around it. You seem to have firsthand knowledge that this is going on. So I assume you're in the room or you're in the meetings when this is happening. And so maybe what you could do is wade into this and see what response you get. Like, I wouldn't charge into this like a bull in a china shop, but maybe put a toe in the water. So maybe in the next meeting or the next setting, you could compliment both of these people. So give your colleague credit for what she's contributed, mention specifically what she's done and why it was a good idea. And then right on the heels of that, give the boss credit for recognizing her talent, choosing her for this assignment, giving her the latitude to get it done. And so he gets credit for recognizing her ability, but she gets credit for the work. So, you know, what we're trying to get here is a win-win. Don't go over the top with this, but, like, you know, see if you can wade in here without getting, you know, the door slammed on your fingers. See how the boss reacts. And most importantly, see how your coworker reacts. If this is something that she appreciates it and she says, thank you for doing that, like, okay, good, you're on the right track. If she's very uncomfortable, like, listen, you don't need to do that for me. I'd rather you wouldn't, then listen. But you know, you see something here, and so I think there's a gentle way to maybe push this in the right direction. But it's an experiment and you gotta see how it goes.
Wow, you know, to reiterate the letter there, I think your advice was spot on. I think you've covered all the bases here, because I thought what I liked about what you had to say, Tim, you not only talked about helping her, but recognizing what the boss needs to do to change his behavior in helping her as well. So I love that, because I think one of the things he has to ask himself is, what's the plan here? What is the plan here? Is the plan here to change her behavior or get her noticed? And I'm not sure which one you want to do. I think what Tim has done is sort of, he's saying, I can do both of these things in a conversation like that. I also thought, I like what you said too, because repeat it, but I liked your saying here, you're not talking to a group. You're not talking to a stereotype here. You're talking to a person who exhibits some particular behaviors that you've noticed that were indicative of others people in a group like that, but are not necessarily conforming to a stereotype. It's just a person in front of you that is quieter than they should be, could be more assertive around what you think they should be doing. But at the same time, again, these are things you could point out, but if they are problematic. And again, I think you have to contextualize it for her and say, what is it you want in life? Do you want to be seen as sort of who you can be in terms of your popularity at this firm, or your ascendance at this firm, or the recognition of your particular abilities? What does she want? I think you should always start with, what does she want? And then say, how can I help you get there? Because I think if you're going to be a supportive friend, you have to say, how can I help you do that? And then if she allows you, here's what I have noticed, and here's what I might suggest. So, and I think you've got to all of those things, Tim, in this.
Well, I really like what you brought up at the end there. I mean, what is she trying to accomplish? And what's not clear from the letters, is she in these meetings? Is she aware this is happening, that this credit's being taken and not given? So the dynamic could be a little bit different based on how this plays out. But I love that idea of what does she want to do here? Last thing on this one, and it reminds me, you know, the old saying that in leadership, if you have an A player, they hire A players, and if you have a B player, they hire C players, because they're insecure, and so they want to kind of keep this gap between them and the people behind them, when really the absolute best leaders, it's about, how do I enable these people to grow and kind of show what they can do and become my peers or even my boss? You know, it's not about me, it's about, bringing out the best in these people. And we don't know if this boss is capable of doing that or not. So, you know, we'll have to see.
Well, the boss to me sounds insecure in some way, because as it was indicated, they're not giving credit where credit is due. And to your point, maybe they just don't realize it. But I think at some level, you should be giving that credit to where it should be accrued, meaning she should be receiving it.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt about it. So,
all right. You know, good luck. I think we've helped them. Yeah, you got it. Yeah, good luck out there in St. Paul.
St. Paul, bundle up. You're probably getting hit this time of year.
Hey, you know what it's time for, Tim? It's time for our seeking sponsors.
Absolutely. Fishing for sponsors. Right. So this is
fishing for sponsors.
This is where our we look for somebody to kind of step in and associate themselves with the quality content that we produce week in and week out, right? So these are not yet sponsors, but we're going to treat them like they are and try to will this into existence.
And remember, when we think of sponsors, we don't have to think in terms of what they will pay us to do this, but rather what they might give us instead, which reminds me of one of my new favorite possibility of fishing for sponsors is Gemini Bistro.
Yes, do tell.
Gemini Bistro. Gemini Bistro is located on Lincoln Avenue here in Chicago, in my neighborhood, as it were, and it's a fantastic place to dine. It's really got great food. I go there on a regular basis. I love their tuna. I'm a real big fan of their burgers, and even occasionally I will get their lovely steak. It's got wonderful atmosphere. The service is great. The wines are good. And if you were going to eat alone, you can eat there at the bar, and people are friendly. So I would recommend. And Tim, do you have any thoughts on the dining experience?
It's lovely. You know, it's funny. I'm going to tie this to last week's episode, because I've been there a couple of times with you. I have to confess that both times before we left, when you got up to use the restroom, I thought you were secretly paying the bill and you weren't. So I was a little disappointed. But that's okay. Gemini, wonderful place, right? We're at 2075 North Lincoln Avenue. Started in 2009, and you're right, the bar is really the centerpiece of this restaurant. It's lovely. If there are two of you, it's a great place. It's a great place to eat. And I remember the first time, I think I was there with you, the way it's sort of this convertible indoor-outdoor space. So there's a whole line of booths and these really large windows. So even if you're technically in the dining room, you get a real kind of al fresco dining experience. Spectacular food. I got so excited when you mentioned Gemini. I downloaded their brunch menu. I've never been there for brunch. Have you ever been?
I have not been there. I'm not a brunch person. I'm not a brunch person. That I don't like to eat at that point in the day.
Yeah. Of course, we've got granola, we've got avocado toast, eggs, Benedict, steak and eggs. And then we kind of dip into the lunch fare with the blackened Caesar salad with chicken, spicy chicken salad, the burger that you mentioned. I mean, it could go on and on. My mouth is watering. I'm going to have to wipe my microphone. Gemini, a wonderful place, again, on 2075 North Lincoln Avenue in Chicago. You know, we will shill for burgers. We will do that.
Oh, that's lovely. All right, let's go on here to our second question. Hey, Tim, it's up to you.
All right, here we go. So this is signed A Dream Team in Dallas. Hey, y'all. I work for a multinational restaurant chain in the corporate offices. I'm now going to be responsible for creating an alumni network. I've been assigned a team of representatives from 7 countries where we have the majority of our restaurants: the US, Canada, France, Spain, Germany, Mexico, and Brazil. We are committing to a 3-day retreat to kick things off. Any suggestions on how to break the ice and get the team acquainted before we start building out an alumni network? Again, signed, A Dream Team in Dallas. Oh, that's a very interesting question.
Yeah, I thought so too. I kind of like the idea of this question in the sense that they're bringing all of this sort of multicultural group together. Now, interestingly enough, I went into our history, the history between Tim and myself. Years ago, Tim and myself created a presentation which we gave to a group of managing partners of accounting firms called Retreats to Advance.
That's right.
You remember?
Very clever. Yeah, that was like over 10 years ago, I think.
Over 10 years ago. It was a wonderful presentation because what Tim did in advance of that presentation, he did what we should be doing. He queried the audience. He queried all the members of the audience on where are their priorities with having a retreat? What is important to them? How would they go about execute? What are some of the best practices they use? What he did is what you should do. In advance of a meeting like this, you talk to people who will be in attendance and you say, what do they need and what do they want from as a consequence of this? In fact, Tim came up with a list of things that we could learn. Again, a couple things right off the top, which makes this very easy. Is have an agenda, right? And then conduct a straw poll ahead of time for controversial topics, so which I thought was very interesting. Don't have really long presentations, also interesting. And then have dispersion of the speakers across the geographical groups, because again, we're dealing with 7 different nationalities here, so we should have some representation. I like this thing too about don't schedule a long meal at the end of a retreat, although you do want networking. And then I thought this was good too. Stay away from your office. If you're going to have this retreat, don't have it in your office because that will distract you or other members of that to go back to the office or do more work, right? And then I like this very small point, but social activities are great, but don't do anything that might hurt anybody. I was never a fan, quite frankly, of these trust falls and things like that. Have you ever done that kind of thing? It's horrible. I have one story about that. I'll be really fast. I was at a retreat for the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, and it was a retreat in Utah. And there's 60 people at this event, and you come in and you go to this event. And what they did was have you ever heard of this activity where there's a circle around a tree, and you have a rope. And you have to get this, you have to get something, it was basically a bag that was at the base of the tree. You had to get it from the base of the tree to the outside of the circle without stepping in the circle.
I see.
and you only had a rope. How do you resolve that?
You make a lasso?
No, you don't.
What do you do?
Okay, well, I solved it. And then, by the way, did I get credit for this? None.
Well, you're
none.
Good opportunity to take some credit right now.
I know. Well, I hope to be a spoiler alert for the listeners is, but what you do is the length of rope is long. So what you do is you have, by the way, I had 60 people. So you stretch the rope out taut and you put half of the people on one end of the rope, half of the people on the other end of the rope, stretch it out taut. And then you abut it to the tree trunk. And then you cross sections with each other, so you end up wrapping the rope around the tree. Now the rope is at sufficient height, being carried by all of these people, that there are now two ropes. Then you take the smallest person there, and you have them monkey climb all the way from the edge of the circle to the tree trunk, pick up the bag and back. And you know who the monkey climber was? It was me.
That's amazing.
But this would
violate my lessons learned, and thank you for quoting those about don't do any activities where someone could get hurt.
I know. Well, my biggest fear is I didn't know if they'd hold that rope long enough to get me all the way across and back. And did they say thank you? No. What kind of seven habits is that? I think the eighth habit should be say thank you.
I'm so glad you shared that story. And listen, we would label that a mundane sports achievement and yet an achievement. That's fantastic. I'm so
I thought so too. Anyway, I know I've taken up my time with this. What do you think we should be doing with these international crowds?
Yeah, well, first, thanks for referencing those lessons learned, that retreat to advance presentation. That whole meeting was really interesting. And you're right. I love the idea of getting some intel ahead of time. What I would say is in advance of this 3-day retreat, this is a lot of time. You got to do at least one and maybe more than one pre-meeting, a Zoom meeting, whatever. Get to know these folks. Do we have any language issues? Are they kind of casual and like to engage, or are they sort of buttoned up? Just kind of know what you're getting into, because there's nothing worse than, you know, rolling out one of these exercises and realizing that half the group doesn't understand what you're talking about or is extremely uncomfortable participating in it. So I think you definitely have to do something like that. You know, the other thing, I worked over the years with many, many companies that have international operations, right? And things, and I've heard you talk about this, you and Mary covered this in many episodes, we sort of default to sort of U.S.-centric thinking and U.S.-centric locations, right? So one of the best things you can do, even though, you know, from this letter, we understand the corporate office is in Dallas, could this retreat be outside the United States? That would send an incredible signal of like, we're coming to you. It's not all about, you know, the default kind of cultural norms of this U.S.-based corporation. I had worked with a company, and they had operations in China. And I remember the first time we had a virtual meeting, and I had to go to the suburbs, and the meeting started at 7:30 p.m. because it was more about let's inconvenience the U.S. Based folks with time as opposed to the other folks around the world time-wise, which is kind of the default for a lot of organizations. So, you know, it's just sort of an acknowledgement that, you know, we know where you are and where you want to work. The other thing is, you know, there's the classic, and we don't have to get into this, the classic storming, forming, norming, performing, you know, that whole like how groups come together. So this isn't going to be a one-time thing, and you shouldn't think of it as a one-time thing where after these 3 days, we're all going to be chummy and we're going to know how this goes. This is something you're going to have to build over time. So I think having that expectation and giving the space for people to get to know each other a little bit over multiple interactions instead of just one big one is important. There was a client that I work with. They had facilities all around the world, and they did QBRs, quarterly business reviews. And what they did was they would rotate where these quarterly business reviews were held. And in some cases, everybody from all the facilities would come to one. In other cases, just the folks from HQ would step through these and kind of host the online meeting. But first from here, and then from Barcelona, and now we're in Singapore or wherever we are. And it just kind of sent this message of, you know, we're willing to come to you. So I think that's what I would say is do a little bit of pre-work from a personality standpoint, sort of who am I dealing with, and give yourself some space that it's going to take some time for this team to come together, and just don't make it all about the U.S. time zone, the U.S. calendars. A lot of times we step on other holidays or non-work days, you know, in other countries that just aren't on our radar screen because we're not as attuned to that as we ought to be.
I think your advice is good. One thing for our listeners is we didn't focus on the structural piece of this in terms of you got to have a goal, you want to have an objective to what the meeting's about and so forth. I assume that you have some comfort around that. One other thing that I thought Tim brought up that really triggered my thought on this is if it's multicultural, then there should be some opportunity to be multicultural. I think if you're going to be together for 3 days, that is actually 9 meals. So, or 8 meals, 8 or 9 meals, I would say I would have a sort of assign everyone a meal and say, you are the host of this meal, and then let everyone do it as they so choose that might be representative of the culture from which they are part of. That way we sort of learn a little bit about each other relative to that, and everyone gets a sort of a part to play. So I throw that out there as well. Anyway.
Chris, I have a question for you.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Because you're the kind of the expert on generational differences, do you see a trend, or can you speak to the trend that may be happening where younger generations want more of a separation between personal life and their work life, and maybe don't see the value in you getting to know me as a person, and only, you know, if we're here to work, what does it matter what my hobbies are and you getting to know me as a person?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because it's layered because, again, we have to take into account the individual, the culture, and then, of course, what is being asked of them in terms of the reveal. I think I would look at this from the premise of trust. I think young people aren't as trusting as we once were with each other. In fact, if you look at the statistics in the United States, when they ask the question, do you trust strangers? Well, this number has gone down from the 70s, and it's now close to the 30s in terms of percentage of people who trust strangers. So my point is, we have to find ways to gain the trust of another. And I think to your point, Jack, is the question is, how do I demonstrate trust? Maybe we should focus on the work itself, that I trust you to do it and I will teach you and all that. But also there's the other aspect of who we are. Who is this person in front of me? And what is your life in terms of what is that? We need to know each other. Now, the question then becomes, how do we get to know each other comfortably? And I think that's what you're getting at, Jack, because I don't want to impose the notion of, okay, we're going to go around the room and you tell us something very private about yourself.
Right.
You see, I think the young might find that, to your point, they may find that offensive, or conversely, they may open up about that. But the question is, I don't know that until I ask you where are you comfortable? So I like your thinking about that, because we have to say, I need to build trust. How's the best way to do that? Knowing that we have to work together.
Yeah, it's like, what is it?
Yes,
like people want to be like, well, this is my work life that I have to do to make money, and just tell me what I have to do for that, and then I'm gonna go home and have my whole other life.
No. You're talking about when they talk about the very young today, they have a curated life. The curated life is to say, this is the aspect of myself that I shall present to who you are in the circumstances of where I am. But the other part of who I am is none of your business until I decide it is part of your business.
Right.
So don't make it part of your business when you don't have the right to do that. So now I'll hear that as a boomer and I'll be offended. Because I'll say, whoa, you don't want to get to know me. And you're saying, this has got nothing to do with offending you. This has got to do with my privacy.
Right.
So in that sense, we're talking across each other as opposed to understanding. So that's why it goes back to the point of develop trust through the lens of asking them, what do they need to do to trust somebody?
Interesting. I like that.
Yeah. Jack, I'm so glad you brought that up, because really, even if somebody, we've got an article here we're going to get into about cultural competence. And you know, I had pulled this one and suggested this is the one we read. And I want to apologize for that because it just kept coming off the printer page after page after page.
It did. It's
a lot of content. But this idea is, even if you are sort of committed to this and sort of culturally aware and you have experience working with people and navigating this stuff, the idea that that next wave of workers coming from another generation may not exactly have the same expectations and behave in the same way, it's complicated, right? So even within our culture here, you know, Chris, you know this better than anyone, those generational differences can create a lot of friction. If you mesh that with cultural differences there, even if, you know, somebody was sort of tuned in to what the older generation would do from a particular culture, that doesn't mean they're up to speed on what the younger folks want to do or how they're willing to work or how much they want to share.
Well, what I think, I guess this, we're going to be running out of time with this article in general, but what I think we fail to do is we fail to give the other party the benefit of the doubt. You see, we read their intentions through the behavior we would engage in as opposed to what they're actually intending in terms of their behavior. And I think people make mistakes. I think we all make mistakes. You know, where have you been where you haven't made a mistake in some kind of, you know, crossed a cultural boundary where that might be inappropriate? I lived in Spain for a year, and one of the things I did all the time was, what do you do for a living? Turns out later on, they don't like that question. Like, hey, what I do for a living is just what I happen to do, but that's not who I am. Why are you starting off with that? You see what I'm saying? So I was inadvertently offending people when it was not my intention to do so. My intention was just to get to know you better. So in that sense, the benefit of the doubt is somebody taking the time to educate you when you do make a mistake in a way that's caring.
Yeah, no doubt. Let me just make a couple comments about this article, which was called Cultural Competence, the Nuts and Bolts of Diversity and Inclusion. Of course, that is a big and complicated topic. This is by Mercedes Martin and Billy Vaughn from Diversity Officer Magazine. I'm going to have to be signing up for my subscription there. And I'm not going to get into any of the detail. Basically, what they talk about is an assessment approach to figure out which of the five stages of cultural competence are you in, and by which then, where do we need to go next, or how do we help this? And I just want to kind of highlight the earliest kind of less developed stage from the end, because it kind of puts some definition around this. So the conventional stage, this is where we lack awareness of bias towards people of other cultures. We perceive our own language and culture as superior to others. We have aversion to cultural differences. That's sort of like, okay, that's square one. This is what we're trying to move away from. At the other end of the spectrum, there's this inclusive stage where you're very aware of any cultural and personal biases. There's consistency between your beliefs, your values, and your behavior. You have positive cultural stereotypes and consider multicultural knowledge something to be valued and something that you seek out. So, and again, if listeners will put this in the description to the podcast, it's an interesting resource. If this is something that interests you, obviously a field of study all on its own, constantly changing in terms of how far can you take this? What's the role of the organization in sort of mandating things? Lots of opinions on both sides. But if it's something you're bumping up against in the workplace, you should certainly take some time to read some of these and other resources that are out there.
Take a lot of time, because Tim gave me the longest article ever.
It's my apologies. All right. And on that note,
he knows you love to read, Chris.
You love to read,
That's
Chris.
That's true. He's a giver. Yeah. He's a giver, and he's giving me what I want.
How about this righteous mind my ass? This is too long, is what I'm hearing from you. All right, folks. Next week, we've got a really interesting episode, a topic we are not scared to tackle. We're going to talk about fear. So you definitely don't want to miss next week's episode. Thank you, Chris, for sharing your wit, insight, and reading list. That was very helpful. Thank you, Jack, our amazing executive producer who makes us sound better than we are. And of course, a big thank you to all our listeners. We want to hear about the drama, the dilemmas, the conundrums you face at work. Send your emails to info@cubicleconfidential, tweets to cubicleconfide1. New episodes almost every Wednesday. We try. Almost every Wednesday, I think, is right. We hope you have a great week. Cubicle Confidential, signing off.